For those of you who don't know me or don't remember me, I'm Arun Dursi Hendrick. I am the physician representative to the Public Health Advisory Council, and I'm also the chair of Public Health Advisory Council, taking over from the very capable Marla Sanger. And so today, I just wanted to welcome everyone to our April FAC meeting, and we're going to start with a roll call. We've got a pretty tight agenda today, but of course we would like to verify who is here, make sure we have a quorum. So when I call your name, can you please indicate that you are present? And I know Lydia will verify whether we have a quorum tonight or not. Elma Blum.
I am here.
John Brooks. Sandra Brown.
I'm here.
Shona Carter. Peggy Carlson.
I am here.
Paul Childers. Tyler Clary.
Present.
Sorry, was that Tyler?
Yes, present.
Mark Collier.
Here.
Heather Decker.
Present.
Remy Houston.
Here.
Adrienne Fairbanks. Dave Fuller.
I'm here.
Stephanie Royce Yamashita.
I'm here.
Marla Sanger.
Here.
Andy Santos.
I'm here.
Cassandra Sellers-Reck. Michelle Stickley. Maria Swinger-Inski.
Guys, can we with you?
Hey. Great. Lydia, do we have a quorum?
Yep, looks good. Thank you.
All right, thank you. If we have any guests at our meeting today, could you please state your name and if you're representing an organization?
I'm not a guest, but I am ex officio. I'm Karen Bowerman, County Council.
Welcome, Karen. Thank you for joining us. All right. So let's go ahead and review and approve our February meeting notes. Hopefully you've all had a chance to look through those minutes. Could I get a motion to approve the previous meeting notes, and will you please state your name?
Sandy Brown, so moved.
Remy Houston, second.
Anyone opposed? Great. Thank you. All right. Well, let's move on next to our agenda, which you should have gotten in an email from Lydia before our meeting. So we will have a few minutes for any public comments. Then we're going to jump into department updates, Dr. Melnick's report, a COVID-19 update. We're going to talk about HB 1152 and how that is going to impact the role of FAC, a budget update, specifically the 2023 budget process, and FAC will have more of an involvement in this year's budget. Because of changes from 1152. And then we're going to spend most of our time talking about department plans and proposals. So talking about the budgeting process, but really taking a deep dive, I hope, or at least starting to, into the strategic planning process. Hopefully that will be a very lively discussion. And then we'll have an executive committee update, specifically talking about a brief meeting in May for our budget, and also going forward, making sure that our FAC meetings are aligning with the requirements from 1152, which is now law, and you can see it's RCW 70.46.140. And then we will close with that. Did I miss anything, Michelle or Sandy or anyone else? You can think of anything else you wanted to add for today. Okay. All right. I don't believe we have anyone from the public here today, but if we do, we have about 2 to 3 minutes for any public comment. Because of our tight agenda, we're not responding to comments today. But if there is anyone here who would like to provide public comment, please state your name and go ahead. All right, then we're just gonna jump right into department updates. And first up is Dr. Melnick presenting a director's report at the COVID update.
So, good evening, everybody. So, Lydia, should I just go ahead and share my screen and then I'll advance the slides? Will that work?
Do you prefer that I take charge of the slides and just let me know when, or do you prefer to take that on?
I'm happy to go either way. I can go. I think I can. Let me see if I can do this on Zoom, and we'll see. Okay. Be prepared in case I mess up here. So, can you all see that?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. Unfortunately, I can't see as many of you now, but let me see if I can get my technology to work here. I'm having trouble getting my mouse over to the other screen and my cursor over to the other screen. So let me see if I can make this work. Let's see. There we go. Okay, it's working now. Okay. First thing is the COVID-19 update, and I'll be as brief as possible so we can get into the meat of the meeting. Things are beginning to increase. The state rate is beginning to increase, and some counties are seeing higher rates than others. So the 7-day case rate statewide through April 16th is 101 cases per 100,000. And although the hospitalization rate remains low, I believe those are increasing as well. So you can see that little graphic at the bottom. You can see that, you know, we're up to 101. It's beginning to increase somewhat. And the highest rates are in the Puget Sound area right now. In Clark County, a few weeks ago, we were down to 24.4 per 100,000 over 7 days. The most recent one, we have complete data through April 16th, is we're at 60 cases per 100,000. So those numbers are beginning to increase as well. You know, given the scale of the graph, you can't see it as well here, but we've more than doubled over the last few weeks. The hospitalization rates are still low, but they're increasing. And as you know, the hospitalization rates lag behind the case rates. We were down, I think, a few weeks ago, below 1 per 100,000. I think it was a 0.6. We're now at 2.4 admissions per 100,000 over 7 days. So that's gone up. And about 5% of hospital beds are occupied by COVID-19 patients. You want it to be below 10%, but that 5% is higher than it was a couple of weeks ago. So those numbers we're going to watch this really closely. I wanted to just talk about the variants. We're still, you know, virtually almost all the cases in the United States, as well as in Washington State and Clark County, are due to the BA2 sublineage of the Omicron variant. And for the week ending April 23rd, it was 97% of cases. There's a new sublineage of BA2, so it's a sublineage of a sublineage, and it's BA2.12.1. And that's actually increasing. It is now responsible for 29% of the 97%. So it went up from 19% to 29%. So this sublineage of the sublineage looks like it may be it's still Omicron, but it looks like it might be even a little bit more contagious than BA2. So we're watching it really closely. So as I mentioned, BA2 is counts for most cases in Washington. 91% of cases, and it takes time to complete the sequencing. So the most recent time period is based on a small number of sequence cases, and that's likely to be adjusted over time. So these data are somewhat preliminary, but the bottom line is virtually all we're seeing is BA2, or almost all we're seeing is BA2, and we have this new sublineage. I really wish I had better news here. We're really stagnating in terms of it's up, including a booster rates up. I don't know what the reason for that is, but only 65% of those who are eligible are fully vaccinated in Clark County. And of those who are eligible for a booster, it would be people 12 and older. Only 56% have had a booster dose. And now you know that for people over 50, second boosters are now recommended. I'll go into that in a moment. But this, you know, vaccination immunity wanes over time, both from infection-induced immunity as well as vaccine-induced immunity. And we have a large susceptible population yet. So our numbers and our case numbers may go up. This is what keeps me up at night. Okay. I think that was it for, I think that's it. I don't know if there are any questions about COVID-19. I want to make it quick so we can get to the rest of the agenda.
Hey, I have a quick question.
Certainly.
I was wondering if there's like a factor built in for what the numbers might be based on people who are positive for home tests. Is that kind of accounted for in the numbers as well?
Yeah, well, it depends on whether, So that's a really great question. This is an undercount because many people who test at home, you can call in and report that you're a case, but many people are testing at home and not calling in. And I don't have a handle on that, but that's substantial. So the case numbers we're talking about here are most definitely an undercount. And I don't have any way of verifying, you know, what the true number might be. And that's likely to continue as over-the-counter tests remain available. Does that answer the question?
It does. I didn't know if there was an algorithm that predicted how many that might be. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it really depends. That's why, you know, one of the measures we really look at is going to be hospitalizations and deaths. The problem with using those is they, you know, by that time, you're already down the road in terms of the increase and the outcome and the bad outcomes. But we're monitoring that all very closely. Peggy, you got a question. You got your hand up.
Yes, I put my hand up. Do we have any data on how many people who are eligible to receive the second booster have received that?
I haven't seen that on the dashboard, and I don't have that yet. If there's anybody from my team who's seen that on the state dashboard, we don't have it for Clark. I'd have to look at that. But I'm not aware that data are available yet. And that's a great question. I'll kind of look into that. But the problem is, I can tell you that, as you can see from these numbers here, there's a large number of people who haven't been boosted, even one booster. And you could look at, you know, anybody on the right-hand columns there, 50 and above, are eligible for booster, and only 2.3% of those 50 to 64 have even received one booster. And you know, there's one quarter of folks who are 65 and older who've only received one, who've not received a booster. So the second booster is going to be somewhat lower than that, obviously, but I don't have the numbers for you at this moment.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Great questions. We need to promote vaccination, especially since it's going to be very difficult, you know, with the numbers go up, it's going to be very difficult to move back towards, you know, physical distancing and mask requirements. Those are going to be challenging, and the best way out of this is for people to get vaccinated. And I point out, I think you've all heard me say this before, that there's nothing wrong with the vaccine. If we look at a lot of the other vaccinations, polio, Haemophilus influenza, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, or whooping cough, measles, mumps, rubella, hepatitis B, hepatitis A, virtually all these vaccines require more than one dose. Sorry, my landline is ringing. I'll mute myself for a second there. Okay, I think that phone will ring one more time. It's in my office or right next to me. I have no way of shutting it off. Okay, I'll move to the budget update. So 1152, and I think Aru said this really well, is now a statute, as you can see there. And we can get you the slides, but you can, or you could just Google RCW 70.46.140. As you know, FACT meets the definition of a community health board, which was in statute. In fact, when they put 1152 together, they used the FACT bylaws to put it together. So, because we met the exception in Clark County, we could maintain the composition of our local board of health, which is made up of our county council, if we had a community health board in place with bylaws as of January 1st, 2021, which we did. So you all meet the definition of a community health board. And under that statute, we now have a member of our board of health, of our county council, as an ex officio member of the of FAC. And that's council chair and board of health chair, Karen Bowerman. So that's all part of RCW 70.46.140. And the other thing, one of the other things the statute does now is says that the community health boards, and this is a language from the law, shall review and make recommendations to local health jurisdiction and local board of health for an annual budget and fee. So you all will actually not only make recommendations around our budget in our health department, but also around the fees, for example, environmental public health fees. And you'll make recommendations to the board of health. And the idea of this is to actually give the Board of Health more community input to help them out. Okay, so I just wanted to give you an idea of how this is going to work for 2023 of the budget. So we're building our draft budget now, and our program managers, our finance team, and our leadership team, we all allocate staff positions, we forecast expenditures, we forecast the activity volume around programs that are fee supported. We forecast project grant and fee revenue, and we review program requests, you know, within our department for additional positions or budget capacity. So we're working on that now. Late May, we would like, which is why we'll be asking for additional FACT meetings over the next couple of months. To review, we would like FACT to review our draft 2023 budget and our environmental public health fee adjustments. And then late May through June, Our leadership team in our department will review the environmental public health fee adjustment scenarios with the county manager, our board of health, and our technical advisory committees, you know, made up of folks from the industry. And we'll present our final draft budget to the June FAC meeting. So hopefully you will all have a meeting in May. You can see it from the second bullet. And then the June FAC meeting will present a final draft budget at the June FAC meeting. And then our deadline is to submit the budget to the county budget office on August 15th. So that's kind of how it will work in the budget timeline. So I don't know if folks have any questions about that. And if anybody on our leadership team in our department wants to add anything, I may have left something out there. I'm hearing nothing on no questions. So that's the end of our report on in terms of the agenda.
Thank you, Alan. So I think we can move on to the next item on the agenda then, which is really going to be the meat of our agenda today. And this is, you know, talking about our strategic planning process, and a part of that is going to be our priority-based budgeting process. So as you all have heard, HB 1152, which is now a statute, really expands the role of our Public Health Advisory Council. And so we really want to take this time to talk about, what this new role for FACT will look like, how FACT can really be more involved and be a more active partner in terms of strategic planning, community needs assessment, and, you know, really the role that we want FACT to play, in our community. And I think it's very exciting because I think FACT can have a much more active role, I think, in really being a leader, I hope, in the community in terms of, guiding our council, but also really looking at how can we best serve, our community. So I will turn it over to Alan who I know has a presentation for this. And then I think we're going to, take time to discuss as a committee, what this means and answer questions, concerns, and hopefully really just start to think about this new role for FAC and how we want to go about engaging in this exciting new work.
Great. So this is a very short presentation. This is mostly going to be your discussion, but I'm going to just give you an idea of how our department does priority-based budgeting, how we decide to put the funds that we have, where we put those. And then what we're going to want to do is get your, have you discuss those. And I'll repeat this again at the end. Whether you see any gaps, are there any measures or criteria that we're missing? So let me give you the background, and I'll show you what the criteria are in terms of how we fund our programs, and then we'll turn it all over to all of you. So I just want to, we use something called the socio-ecologic model, and I'm going to give you this kind of a layer cake. A previous Board of Health member called this a layer cake, but we use, our programs can work at different levels, and one is, programs that are directed, interventions that are directed at individuals. And I'm going to give you an example using how we address tobacco over the last 50 or 60 years in public health. There are interventions that were address peer groups, small groups, interventions, public health interventions that work at the organizational level, at the community level, and interventions that address policy. And generally, you get a bigger bang for your buck as you move down the as you move down the layer cake to the bottom. So, and I'll use tobacco as an example. So, some of the interventions around tobacco at the individual level are, you know, quit lines for individuals, tobacco cessation classes, could be some medications around that we give to people to reduce craving for tobacco. And those are effective, but they're not, you know, they work at the individual level and they help, but they're limited. The next level that we work at is at the interpersonal level. So we may get work on developing teen peer groups, for example, that work with their fellow teens to discourage smoking and speaking out about the health effects of tobacco. As you move to the organizational level, you get to these systems, more systems changes. For example, smoke-free workplaces, you know, companies that, and you can apply this to other things as well, whether it be vaccinations or, you know, or any masking or whatever. But, you know, using tobacco as an example, it might be those early organizations, you know, five decades ago that were, you know, creating the first smoke-free workplaces or smoke-free housing. Then you get to the community level where you get coalitions and community groups. You get organizations like the Lung Association, the Heart Association, doing a lot of work around changing community norms and standards around, you know, for example, tobacco. Certainly, if you watch Mad Men, you know, you can see how the culture around tobacco has changed over 50 years. And a lot of that was, you know, community changes. And then finally, you get down to the policy level, and this might be taxes on tobacco or indoor smoking laws. You know, it wasn't that long ago that I think it was the late 80s that you could still, there were smoking sections on airplanes. I didn't realize. To me, that seems fairly recent. You know, banning tobacco on our airplanes, tobacco taxes, indoor smoking laws, all that. And I would point out that, you know, those changes tended to affect, you know, much larger groups of people. And, you know, all of these were important. Certainly the individual level, measures help people who are affected by these public policies, but you get more effective measures as you move to the larger policy level. So I'm going to show you the criteria. We use this in some of our criteria, but the next slide is going to talk about priority-based budgeting, and then I'll talk about the criteria we're using. So we take a look at all our programs and services in our department, and we align them with department priorities, and we try to direct our, you know, what limited funding we have, we want to be good stewards of funding, to areas where we can be most effective. And we've developed a tool we wanted to share with you and get your input on that will help with prioritizing funding while developing the 2023 budget. And the tool assigns scores to programs based on several measures that I'm going to show you right now. So, one of the things we're asking when we look at our program's intervention, is it a mandated function? The state law mandated, and examples of mandated functions, for example, are communicable disease control programs, you know, responding to notifiable conditions, vital records, you know, birth and death records. Our environmental public health programs are mandated. For example, restaurant inspections are mandated by state law. So one of the questions are, is it a mandated function? And even if it is a mandated function, are we providing services beyond the mandate? Next, another criteria, is it a foundational public health service? And, you know, we got increased funding, the legislature has given us increased funding over the last a few years for foundational public health services. And these are core public health services that protect and improve the health of the community. And by the way, there can be some overlap here too. So some of the mandated functions like communicable disease control are also foundational public health services. The other thing about foundational public health services that there is, those are services that are primarily or only provided by the public health system and are services that are based, that address populations, not individuals. So healthcare, for example, is not a foundational public health service. That's something that's done by our healthcare partners and not generally by us. So again, communicable disease and environmental public health are examples of foundational public health services. There's also, along with this funding, is another criteria. Is it a foundational public health service capability? And these are capabilities within our health department, such as our epidemiology, our assessment unit, emergency preparedness, communication. As you've seen, it's been very important during the pandemic. Policy development and community partnership development and business competencies. You know, if you don't have the business competencies, you can't do the services. So those are capabilities that we need to have in place. Beyond foundational public health services, some of the other services that may not be foundational are they additional important services? So these are services that might be critical locally, but do not necessarily need to be provided by us. And the examples of that are the Women, Infants, and Children Nutritional Program, or WIC. We used to provide that in our department. It's now provided by a partner. CMAR provides WIC in our community. And vaccine administration. I mean, we've done some mobile units in targeting populations like in adult family homes who are hard for our private partners to reach. But the vast, vast, vast majority of vaccines are administered by our healthcare partners, not by us. They're very important, additional important services, but they don't necessarily need to be done by government. And if there aren't partners available to do that in the private sector, that's where we might have to step in. But those are additional important services. So we're looking at that as well. We're looking to see if one of the criteria is it a program that can be done in partnership with another department within our county? Is it regional? Are we working with partners on this? Get economies of scale and providing regional services. Another question we ask, is it evidence-based? If there's no evidence, scientific evidence that a program works, we're going to treat that very differently than something that is based on evidence. And for example, we know that, our vaccine programs are based on evidence. Does it support racial equity? Racial inequities are a key public health indicator. They're core to public health. And we're taking a really close look at that, both by, where we put our funding as well as working with our department and getting us all up to speed on addressing racial equity in our basic work. So that's true in our programs as well. Is it a priority for a critical partner? What's the primary focus? If it's an additional important service that we already mentioned, look at the primary focus of the service. There's different levels of prevention. I'll be quick as I can on this. So, when you intervene to prevent to improve the health of the community, there are different ways that you can intervene. And they're called levels of prevention. So, and I'll give you an example. Primary prevention is an intervention, a public health intervention that you do before somebody gets sick or has a health condition. And an example is vaccinations. You give vaccinations when people are well because you want to prevent them from getting sick. That's primary prevention. A secondary prevention is you might want to screen a population to find a health condition early before it becomes more severe or life-threatening. So examples of secondary prevention are screening for high blood pressure and treatment for high blood pressure before somebody gets a stroke, or mammography, screening for breast cancer really early on, colorectal cancer as well, and intervening before somebody has becomes spread and difficult to treat. And then tertiary prevention is managing a disease after it has become significantly manifest. So treating breast cancer or treating colorectal cancer or rehab after a stroke would be examples of tertiary prevention. We in public health want to be as upstream as possible and intervene early on. So we tend to look at primary prevention as, in terms of prioritizing where we put our resources, as greater than secondary prevention or greater than tertiary prevention. I showed you the layer cake of the socioecological model. We look at interventions on those different levels and whether we're addressing individuals, organizations, communities, or policy. We also look at the prevalence of the condition in our community. So we work with our assessment unit, see what are the conditions that are affecting the health of our community, and we put our resources into preventive measures that are addressing some of the highly prevalent conditions in our community. And, you know, while we're concerned about very rare diseases, it is, you know, one of the criteria we look at is what is the burden of this condition or illness for the people who live in Clark County? How severe is it? Is it a mild condition that we're trying to prevent or severe? What's the mortality from that? And then we look to see whether priority populations are being addressed, including, you know, this is where we also get into work around racial equity, but making sure that that we're addressing populations that might be at risk for some of these conditions and have limited access to services. So based on all these criteria that I've listed here, our leadership team is going to be working on assigning scores to program services based on these metrics and, you know, and deciding where we put our resources. And some of these measures may be weighted more heavily. So, for example, primary prevention and weighted more heavily than tertiary or secondary, and maybe weighting measures heavier towards the policy level compared to the individual level. But the question for all of you on FAC, and I'll shut up here, is what do you think about these criteria? Are there any gaps? Are there any measures or considerations that we're missing? Because when we come back to you with our budget recommendations, are going to be based on using these criteria. So I'll stop there and turn it over to all of you. And we're taking notes, by the way, I hope. And I'm leaving the criteria up there so you can see them. Also, on my leadership team, on our leadership team, if I left anything out, feel free to chime in.
Dr. Melnick, what about accessibility and thinking of people with disabilities or maybe not even disabilities, maybe people who don't speak English or people who might not be able to, like, is accessibility a part of the equation when we're looking at the services or at the goals or the budget measures?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we may need to flesh out, is a priority population being addressed, but certainly people with access challenges, a variety of barriers to access, would be a priority population, and that's a really good point. We may want to, for example, when, you know, we're doing mobile vaccination pods to adult family homes, that was a population that really couldn't get to a provide, you know, a provider in the community for vaccines. So that was a priority population. I think populations that have a variety of access barriers. When we were looking at, we were working with our BIPOC community partners on getting vaccinations to other populations that might have, that had difficulty getting access to vaccines. So that needs to be put into the, I agree that, you know, we could make that a little bit more clear in the priority populations. I don't know if any of my other, any of the rest of the leadership team want to weigh in on that either. So I'm doing a lot of the talking here.
This is Shona. I agree that the priority population should be fleshed out a little bit more, also to include folks with disabilities, maybe seniors, veterans, et cetera.
So, yeah, so senior, and if you, you all think of others, so seniors, people with disabilities, language. BIPOC populations.
You have language.
Language.
Seniors, disabilities, language. Young people. Veterans.
What was that?
I said young people.
Mm-hmm.
Children, maybe. LGBTQI.
I think maybe there's an opportunity to tie our priority population work into concepts of targeted universalism and our racial equity priority focus, knowing that if we center specifically racial equity work, that all of the priority populations that will, that were just mentioned will be centered and will also benefit from our review and restructuring of institutional inequities and policies that are fundamentally designed to exclude and prohibit populations from achieving wellness and being centered, right? Whether it's language or access, or any other demographic-based characteristic that, that lends itself to either having access, being white, cisgendered, heterosexual male, right, married, all of those characteristics, or then the intersections of any kind of any other identities, truly in America. So
I'd like to add to what we just heard that, and maybe this is redundant to what we just heard, but I don't think it is, that we would, I would like it if we can frame some way that we particularly concern ourselves with populations who are disproportionately harmed by various things that are occurring in our current present world, state, county, et cetera, such as the ongoing presence of an illness that we have been not able to really bring totally under control, the financial stress that's caused by that, as well as other things like inflation, and that those things tend to become a pile-on. And so for folks who are disproportionately disadvantaged when any of those things occur, that we somehow call out that people who might be in that situation and just want to make sure that we're keeping them on our radar screen, regardless of what their reason may be for being in that situation. So the other thing, and this is a little bit of a side trip, but I don't want to forget to bring it up, and that is, this is kind of just something to keep on maybe a parking lot, but I don't want to forget about it, and that is when the public goes to the public health website and looks up Public Health Advisory Council, there's a image there that describes the priority issues addressed by FAC, and the years that are represented are 2003 to 2015. And while I was in the chair role, it concerned me quite a bit, but there were many other things going on that were real-time needing attention, and I didn't take it on.
now that I'm not in that role, maybe I can help with this, but I would, but this is 7 years later from when that diagram has ended. So if there's some way we can, along the way, try to incorporate our thinking and our strategies around how we're going to move forward, that we populate something on that particular page when people go to see what FACT is all about and see current information about what we're doing to address. And these things that you have on the list for priority-based budgeting measures, they should all roll up to what are the big aims, strategies, you know, and then objectives and tactics and that kind of stuff. So it doesn't have to be, none of this stuff has to be mutually exclusive. It should work together to get us to where we want to be.
Thanks for pointing it out, Marla. That's really helpful. We'll see about updating this.
Is there anything else that anyone wanted to add to the priority-based budgeting measures? Great. Well, thank you everyone for such a great discussion. I think this will actually set the stage very nicely for talking more about the strategic planning process. And you know, I'd like to walk everyone through you know, what this entails, at least the way that I understand it. And you know, please feel free to correct me if I'm misspeaking here. But if you remember, at our last meeting in February, we talked about what are some projects that FACT would like to take on in this new year. And we had asked everyone to think about, you know, one or two projects that you feel passionate about that you would like to see FACT take on. As we start to think more about this, I think one of the really important pieces is we want to make sure, you know, that we're doing this in a very methodical, strategic way that aligns with, you know, what our community needs. And so the way that I think about the strategic plan is really starting from a community needs assessment and partnering with some of the wonderful community partners, you know, where we essentially don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, there's a lot of wonderful partners doing a lot of the work. And so how do we, you know, share data with these community partners? How do we get data from these community partners? And really, I think focusing in on, you know, what does our community need? What is it that FACT can play a key role, you know, as key community stakeholders? So I think, you know, I see this as, you know, rather than picking one or two projects like right off the bat, to really take a step back and think about the big picture, you know, and public health can do a needs assessment, but what we also really need along with the needs assessment is these partnerships with or facilitators, right, with community partners to really help us implement the strategic plan and also to help us evaluate this plan over time. Is it working? You know, what do we need to improve upon? What are some of the challenges that that are in our way as we try to implement our strategic plan? And so really it's a question of what does our community need? Who's doing what? So we don't duplicate the work. And then how can FACT, you know, play a role in this? And I think this, you know, ties really nicely into talking about the priority-based budgeting, but our racial equity work, and, you know, these key partners that we talk to can include community service organizations, the healthcare sector, education, transportation. You know, there's so many of these partners, and there are, you know, specific templates that we can look at so we make sure we're not forgetting anyone in this work. And, you know, we don't really have, I think, a strategic plan right now that that would kind of include all of these pieces that we're talking about. And I think this also really ties into, you know, FAC is going to be taking on a more active role because of HB 1152. And I think, you know, it's really up to all of us to think about, you know, how can we contribute both as individual members, but also as, you know, FAC to bring about these community partnerships and to help with these needs assessment. You know, what are our passions? What are our skills that we can bring to the table? And then, you know, how do we then start and continue this work? And, you know, what does that mean for the budget? What does that mean for, you know, how often we're meeting? And so I think there's a lot to talk about today. So I wanted to see if anyone else from the Executive Council or our public health staff had anything to add to that right now.
This is Sandy, and I just think it's a good, it'll be a good process for us to lay some good groundwork for our future work, in a more strategic way. And so I'm excited to get started and kind of see where we head with this and give us some kind of hands-on projects to work forward and policy that we could work on or whatever. There's a lot of new things out there and, where to start is sometimes difficult, so this kind of planning will help us do it in a more organized fashion. So,
and Arun, to get back to one of the earlier threads that you were connecting in terms of the priority populations that were mentioned and the budget dialogue, and then the opportunity to systematically review the bodies of work, the priorities that have been identified by our partners, is a key difference in how we're going to approach the needs assessment and meta needs assessment for this body of work moving forward. Because there are whole agencies that are dedicated to serving young people, to serving our aging population, right? And so how do we work together to power the work and to your point, to deduplicate? So that's something that we're really going to be looking for themes, for patterns, for sense of priority, for urgency, to be able to assess and then measure and align health outcomes that we can collectively kind of row our boats towards in the future as we kind of move the work forward.
In terms of getting started, yeah. Aru, you handled, you know, you nailed it, but I just wanted to throw out there that the statute basically puts you in a position to do the work that you just brought. I threw that up there, and I think I'm not going to read it. You can all see that. And just in terms of getting started, you know, our team is exploring processes that, for this, and, you know, we have a parallel process going on, with a community health assessment and community health improvement plan and involving community organizations and stakeholders, identifying their priorities and providing input. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. There's a lot of activities going on around this. And we want, you know, we need to do our strategic plan, and we can benefit from these. We want to make sure that key stakeholders, we don't want to miss any stakeholders in this. We want to be as inclusive as we can, and FAC will be really important in this to make sure, just like we didn't miss any criteria, and that was a great discussion to make sure that we don't miss any key community stakeholders in terms of input. And whatever we do in terms of this in our strategic plan, it will serve as a foundation for us in our work plans moving forward. So I'm gonna stop sharing there so we can all see each other a little bit better.
Can I add something?
Go ahead.
Dr. Monette?
Sure.
I think part of what we've done in the past, quite honestly, is we've done our strategic planning in a vacuum. And we haven't necessarily used the data that we're getting from the community in an effective way. It's not that we didn't use it. It's not that we weren't aware of it. We just didn't really incorporate it the way that we needed to. And really what we're looking at, I think the COVID pandemic and our response to that has made us very, very aware that our strategic plan and our approach has a huge impact on the community and vice versa. You know, the work that the community is doing has a huge impact on, you know, what we are doing as well in public health and what we should be doing. And so including, you know, having this process now move forward so it's not in a vacuum. We include our community partners. We include the data that we're getting from the community health assessments that they're doing, the community health improvement plan that, you know, that our team is developing based on all of that data that's already existing out there. That is exactly what needs to drive our internal strategic plan. And then we need to determine what pieces of that community need out there is being met by our external partners and how can we support them in continuing to do that work. And that what piece of it is really public health's role and how do we carve that out so that we have our internal strategic plan. So all of our work plans within public health are aligned with that. And we are measuring how we're meeting that need. But it's all based on this community input and community feedback that we're getting. So it's really more of that whole, when we talked about community health strategist kind of approach, that's the approach that we're really trying to incorporate this time around. And we really want to make sure that we don't do this in a vacuum. Not only will FAC have a role to play in this and our community partners, but also, you know, we're looking at our internal staff members, our other partners within the county, our city partners, our healthcare partners, I mean, just across the board, our regional partners. So we really want to make it a comprehensive approach this time around so that we can really understand what is truly going on in the community. And I think, Aru, you said it earlier about not duplicating work. You know, the worst thing in the world would be that that public health is doing an effort and there's three other community partners who are also doing a parallel effort and never the four should meet kind of a thing. So we really want to get to a point where we are really understanding what's going on in the community, how we can continue to support that work, but then really what is public health's role and how can we augment what's going on in the community? I also am really excited because by aligning our internal work plans with the strategic plan, we're going to measure and be able to evaluate how we're doing, and we'll bring that back to FAC and we'll share that, and, you know, we can course correct and all of that. But ideally, that's really going to be how we end up telling our story. I mean, Marla, you said, you know, you talked about our website, you know, being like super outdated. Well, it is because we don't tell our story very well, and I do think that, you know, this gives us an opportunity to say this is really what's happening in our community and not make it so public health internally focused, but this is really what's happening in the community and this is all the work that's going on in the community and we're all rowing the boat in the same direction like Andrew was saying. We're all rowing the public health boat in the same direction. So really excited about this process and I think it's going to be a much more robust data-driven process than we've done in the past. And looking forward to including FAC in that process as well.
Just adding one sentence. I'd go back to the socioecologic model, that layer cake, because there's a lot of places for all of our partners and stakeholders to kind of work together on those different levels. But
so I would like to make a comment on what Roxanne said about the various agencies. There are many agencies in our community that are required to do a community health needs assessment. So I worked on that when I was with Peace Health in my last role there. And I also was on a group that met in Portland that was trying to combine counties' community health needs assessment, saying, why are we doing this in each separate county? Why don't we do that together, create the wonderful, you know, needs assessment, and then take action on that. And it was a little mind-bending to try to knit those things together, because when I work on the one for Peace Health, I included the public health department. I included schools. Not me only, but the group that was working on it. I had responsibility. But we pulled in lots of interagency people that also do the same kind of work and try to minimize the amount of duplication. It's really hard because each organization that is required to do this has to meet whatever the criteria is for their agency. So what I think I learned from that is to do the best we can to pull information from work that's already done and that is ready to be utilized, rather than to spend a lot of time coming to the same conclusion that they came to at Peace Health or at, you know, various many other agencies that are doing this work, and not spend too much time analyzing so that we become paralyzed by that and don't start taking action. I don't think there's anything wrong with moving forward, identifying something early on and looking at all these assessments saying, oh yeah, that's right, and saying this is something that we should do no matter how much more data we go through. This should be done. One of my personal examples would be, why are we having such a low rate of vaccinations? We're talking about a deadly disease that hasn't gone away. Is there something that could be done about that? So that's just an example, and I'm sure there are many others. So that was just one thing I wanted to say. And as far as our diagram on our website, it doesn't bother me that it's out of date, but what I would really like to see is that it is real time. So it's okay with me if it says for item number vaccination rate improvement, it says work in process. Here's what we've done so far, or something like that. So that's my two cents. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Marla. And I think it's so helpful to have, that experience that you're talking about, that I think you and, you know, others are bringing, you know, so much experience to FAC. And I think where we can all contribute individually and as a team is, you know, we're all bringing different life experiences, work experiences. Some of us have, like yourself, Marla, have done community needs assessment. Others, like myself, are hearing about it for the first time. But I think we all bring, you know, different skill sets, different community partnerships and connections. And I think putting that all together will be really powerful. I know Peggy has her hand up.
I'm wondering, do we already know where current assessments live? Like, have we identified? What comes to mind for me is the Healthy Youth Survey, which is given to all, you know, 6th through 12th graders. And they also did a COVID-19 student survey, and a lot of those questions were health related. And so I'm just wondering, are there other examples of current assessments and we need to find them, or what?
Yeah, there's a Healthy Youth Survey. There's a BRFIS, a Behavioral Risk Factor Survey that's done. There's the hospitals are required to do community health assessments. Other organizations, one of the things that, you know, that's what I meant about being as inclusive as possible. There's a lot of data sources in the community. A lot of people are doing this work. Our team probably has more, can list more than I just listed. Andrew, you probably have a few that you can add.
Thank you. You added a bunch. But, yeah, I think most organizations either have a formal or informal needs assessment, right? Federally funded agencies have them. Head Starts, Community Services, Peace Health just released theirs. The Major Columbia, or the Columbia Willamette Collaborative, right? There's the one up the gorge. There's all sorts of materials, right? And I would hazard a guess that there's going to be interoperable themes between those reports. So it's a question, right? And Michelle, you and I, we've had these discussions in the executive session, like, how do you know that you're getting to all of the organizations, right? And there's different ways that you can ensure that you're canvassing, right? We have a team of health assessment and evaluation professionals who are incredible at their jobs. And they'll go find that information, right? And they'll collate it. You can collate it in different ways. You can collate it along the life course, right? Prenatal, birth, early childhood, school age, right, young adulthood. You can go all the way through the life course. You can do it by risk factor. You can do it by demographic. There's all sorts of ways that we can organize to ensure that we're collecting all of the information, and then we need to analyze it and then put out our meta report, right, because most public serving agencies are contributing to or directly working towards improvements in social health and mental behavioral outcomes. So that's kind of what our approach will look like. And then we'll be able to kind of move it forward from there. With, I think, the goal too of consolidating what some of that looks like, and to the degree possible, and this would be, I think, a huge goal for our community, is to standardize those measures, right? There's a lot of standardized primary measurement in the healthcare system, right? How many, like EPSDT standards of care, right? How many vaccines did your kiddo receive to be up to date on their series, right? How many well child visits have they gone to, right? That's a discrete primary data measurement that is a larger indicator for things like child wellness, or kindergarten readiness, right? Or so we can start to have discussions about what contributes to and what's a good measure for how we want to evaluate how good we are at moving towards a goal state. And that could also be the number of policies we have. It could be so many different things, but to have that discussion, to really meet deeply, meaningfully, and regularly, and then assign FTE to monitor and evaluate and move that work forward. And that's where historically public health as a discipline at the local level, at the state level, in Maryland, in Ohio, Colorado, Washington, we fall short, right? We build really great plans, and then we don't have the resource to follow through. And that's something that we're talking about a lot, too.
Well, and I think, too, to add to Andrew, what Andrew is talking about is when we include these stakeholders that are already doing the work, how much more power that gives to the community that are involved with these stakeholders, that those numbers matter, that they matter. And that, you know, is such an invaluable concept, right? Because those people that are seeking those services and even that are working in those nonprofits, in those stakeholder organizations, they're bending over backwards. And when they see that, oh yeah, you know, public health really is listening, they want those numbers. Our numbers do matter. I think that impact that Andrea is talking about, that Aru is discussing, you know, those are things that I think we could just be the leaders in our area on. So I think I'm really excited about the strategic plan, the way we're going about it, and all the minds that are putting, you know, their input in. So I'm hoping everyone else is too.
One thing I wanted to mention is, you know, we're talking about a lot of different data sets and all that here. I'm hoping that we'll be doing a lot of community listening sessions and we'll be doing some key informant interviews that can help us identify key informant interviews. We'll be doing focus groups. We're using Snowball, you know, different techniques to be able to listen to people from all over the community with different life experiences. So I believe that's going to be part of the process as well. And I think there are several others of you on this call that probably have data as well. I mean, Sean, I don't know if the Community Foundation has data. I assume that you have some information as well.
Yeah, we recently started our strategic plan as well and went through a discovery phase where we interviewed many different types of stakeholders. So our donor stakeholder and our grantee nonprofit stakeholders, more specifically, some other funders as well. But and it was a broad range of questioning, right? So it's, you know, what are some of the most pressing issues in the region, and it also extended across three counties, so Skamania, Cowlitz County, and Clark County. So we can probably disaggregate that data by county and just pull up some things that way, but if I had to just give you a brief overview of what kind of came up through all of those stakeholders, it's housing, housing, housing all day long. And so, we're not at the end of the process, but I think we are pivoting towards, and we have a new CEO, so I'm not certain on this, but I definitely believe that the foundation is going to be focusing on that, because you can't have good health, you can't get behavioral mental health services, you can't focus in school, you can't get a job, if you're not safe in a house and have stability. So that might be a space where we might be stepping into. And I can share whatever data that comes out of that. We're still kind of playing with the data.
I love that. And so then like a critical thought exercise might be, what's public health's role in supporting agencies that have a direct role in improving the housing culture in our county or our region? And while our role may not be securing direct housing resources for individuals and families and organizations, but our role might be working towards building policies that help families build wealth. Because wealth, not income, right, is the thing that allows families to create and purchase houses, right, and to move into those spaces and then pass that wealth on to their children. And there's connections in terms of education and access to opportunity and things like that, and then also contribute to health outcomes, right? So it's all very interconnected. But then, so to understand what strategies are available and what the right role is, given any set of resources or space continuum in time, whether that's a year, a 5 year, a decade, right? Because the role of public health practice has also evolved, I think, throughout the pandemic, and it was evolving even before then in terms of what do we do relative to our allied partners and adjacent work, right? I think the healthcare sector is a really good example of that, because I think a lot of people look to public health and like direct patient care, right? And you see this divestment of, or handing back over, rather, that's probably a much better term, of direct service to our partners. And then we're focusing on that community level work, right, to support the direct investment of resources into our community partners so then they can see those improvements and then we help them to measure that success. So, and just as a quick example, a timely example, we're working on a needs assessment for our pregnant and parenting young children family space right now. And so to provide a use case example of what Dr. Melnick was mentioning about the key informant interviews, the focus groups, the surveys, right, all of the ways that you can connect in with individuals or your stakeholders, it's a good example, right? There's call lines. If you have limited access to internet, you can take paper surveys. It's in 13 languages. They're open-ended questions. There's multiple ways, doors, to be able to provide your feedback. There's oversampling of populations. It's all based on co-design, right? So our community partners helped us design the questions. We didn't design them, and to collect the information we thought was important. So there's a lot of cool things and ways that you can make your, the data collection unbiased as possible, right? Because there's inherent in the rules and restrictions around a formalized process, right? There's going to be It builds in bias, and we're going to do our best to strip that away whenever possible. Or if it exists, acknowledge it and the limitations of that, and then move forward. Right.
Yeah, and I think just building on what everyone has talked about, I think what's really exciting about this is this work, this needs assessment, this strategic planning moves us into like the DEI space, the diversity, equity, inclusion space. Because we are listening to everyone, hopefully everyone in the community. And I feel like that is something that historically has just really not been a focus or a priority, for the healthcare sector, for, public health. And this is, and I'm just speaking more kind of nationally, too, not, criticism at any particular organization, but I think that's really exciting that we will actually make sure that we're listening to everyone. And it's just, as I hear the discussion around housing and, you know, income and wealth and, you know, how that can be intergenerational. And, you know, it's just very exciting that we're like starting to acknowledge that and talk about that and not, you know, shy away from that. Other thoughts, questions, ideas, concerns?
One of the things that keeps me up at night is how healthy the ecosystem of our nonprofit partners are, and how when we make decisions around priority budgeting areas, how we can help build the capacity of organizations as well. On top of all of the work that they have to do, I think that there's limited resources that go towards, you know, building out the capacity of organizations to provide services. And so that's another thing that bubbled up in our in the discovery phase of our strategic planning that's super important and that I'm hearing often.
So that's a really good point. So if I understand this correctly, we ought to be looking at community assets and mapping those as well, and figuring out where the gaps are and how we can help sustain and build community capacity. We need to add that, because I mean, we always talk about needs. We don't talk about assets and assets and community capacity that we want to support. So we need to. We need to capture that.
The other thing I wanted to mention is I heard you, Andrea, when you talked about co-designing, and I think another aspect of co-design when we're looking at potentially recommending certain solutions is that we co-design with the people that we're talking about, not the people that we're going to work with, but the people we intend to be served by these strategies and by these aims. So I remember Dr. Melnick was very patient with me when we were talking about the ventilator, project, the criteria for how to distribute ventilators in a crisis. And I thought that we might have a person that's on a ventilator as part of that team or someone. And I think you found someone who had a family member on a ventilator. That's what I'm talking about, is having people with real life current experience in these things that we're trying to address, because they will be so informative in ways that Having invited patients to be on, for instance, an ICU patient I invited while she was still in the ICU to work on ICU improvements. And as soon as she was well enough, she joined the team. And you just get such a different and enlightening perspective when you do it that way.
You actually learn a lot also. I mean, I remember when we were looking at ventilator allocation, we were concerned about people who are on home ventilators and what we wanted input from them. So we reached out to the ALS Association and found other folks, and I actually learned something. I learned that you can't use home ventilators in an ICU. They don't work that way. So you also learn things that you wouldn't know otherwise until you talk to the people who are involved in that.
Just wanted to mention about, housing. The Planning Commission and others have been moving through the system a 2-year housing option study and action plan for Clark County. And it's kind of beginning to culminate. And I want to give you a couple of dates, because as I think about it, I really am not sure how public health enters into the considerations that are in that report right now. And just after this discussion, I'll be reading it with different eyes than I would have before, but there's a work session that is going to be on that report on May 4 at 9 a.m., and that will be something that is televised, available for everyone to see and hear. And then there's a public hearing on it on May 17. That's a Tuesday at 6 p.m., which is our council meeting. And at that time, there's a list of recommendations in the study and action plan that is, in fact, the action part of it all. And so the segments of that it is felt should be a part of what is adopted for Clark County can be brought forward. And very often, they grow out of that public hearing. Testifying at those public hearings is a very important thing to do. So if that's something that is of interest to you, let's see how that ties in with public health and make sure that it does.
And I think it will tie in unique ways that we may not have considered, right? So the City County Health Rankings just released a 6 webinar series on the impact of wealth and health, and it's absolutely fantastic. And it centers
who did that?
City County Health Rankings. I'll forward it to this group. It's so good, and it really starts to dive into concepts between public and private goods and the health economy and connections between the capacity to build wealth and public health specifically. Our, you know, kind of 1.0 version, our metric was income, right? And the difference between measuring income and measuring wealth and what wealth will allow you to attain and achieve, and how wealth is a proxy for health and how that manifests. So, and housing really comes up, right? Redlining is discussed because it's policy driven. Like, how do we disrupt the racially institutional practices, racially driven, and right, grounded in racism, and they go back 200 years, and they deck it out, and they explain how we got to where we are, and how much work would take to undo that damage, right? And so housing is central to those 6 webinar discussions, and can't disconnect the two. Wealth, housing, education, health. Right, but it forces us to lens it and look at the system differently, right? And so then what is public health's role relative to what we know now versus what we knew, as, you know, because it's a practice and we're constantly learning. Highly recommend it, really engaging, and there's different speakers that join each webinar, but I think that if housing is going to keep coming up, right, what would our right role be and how could we contribute to those improvements at a community level? I think it would be really interesting to have that dialogue here.
Can you put the link on in the chat, Andrea? And I just wanted to acknowledge, and everybody else saw the light in Andrea's eyes as she spoke about those webinars.
I think the link is in the chat. And Councilor Bowerman, did you say that was, I just want to make sure I have it in the notes correctly, for Lydia and I are both co-taking notes tonight. So is that the 19th, did you say? Oh, you're on mute.
My dog had been talking to me. Wednesday, May 4 at 9 a.m. is the work session.
Right. Okay.
And then the public hearing is Tuesday, May 17 at 6 p.m.
They're in the second chat. I put the wrong one in first, and the second one I put in the chat has exactly what Council Chair Bowerman is alluding to. It's got them. So link to the May 4th work session and then the Tuesday, May 17th hearing.
Thank you so much.
That's it. Thank you.
A
Other thoughts?
I just have a request. I was going to send a chat, but I don't want to send everyone. But if someone knows, I do not know how to save all these links that are in the chat string after the meeting ends. So if anybody knows how to do that, if they could please send me a message or put it in the chat so I can look at all these things.
Marla, it's yeah. The three dots in the chat, the three little dots, it'll say save chat.
Perfect. Thank you.
It does.
So I think one of the questions I have is, you know, this is obviously a lot of important work, and I think sometimes it can feel a little daunting to think about the task ahead. So I'm wondering what ideas people have about, you know, how do we get started on this? You know, what's that first step we take, right? Or what's that first couple of steps we take? And this is just how my brain works. You know, I like to break things down into like little pieces and say, okay, here's the first thing we're going to do, right? Whether as an individual or as a team. So I'm just, you know, kind of throwing it out there for, you know, how do we kind of tackle this, and what are our next steps?
Are you talking broadly for FACTS role in the ongoing discussions, or next steps for kind of Clark County Public Health to bring back to FACTS? Our internal next steps will probably be most supportive for future FACT meetings after we finalize this budget session, right? With the team, Judge Melnick, would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, we do have a budget to go through with all of you over the next couple of months, but our job is to facilitate this process and give you all and help you give what you need to help with this. So we'll be bringing information to you to help with this process and help getting. We're still going on with this. What we're actually thinking of doing, let me add a little bit to this, because this is a lot of work for our department as well. We're looking at, in terms of the strategic planning process, to bringing a contractor to help with this process, somebody in any organization that really does this kind of work. So our leadership team is looking at that, and we'll be bringing that back to you as well, because this is going to be a huge undertaking to redo this, not only to redo the strategic plan, but do it in a way that gets broad. We don't want to miss the boat on this. We really want to make sure we get all the, we don't want to miss any stakeholders on this. We want it to be a comprehensive, community-based strategic plan. So as we look at this, we'll bring information back to FACT, but we're looking at bringing a contractor to help with this. And this is a, you know, we're talking about priority-based budget. This is a foundational public health service to doing this work. It's part of the assessment piece, and that's a foundational public health service. I don't know if anybody on our team wants to add anything to that. The state FPHS funding should help with that.
Any other thoughts? Questions, concerns? I think we've had a really great discussion, lots of great ideas, lots of excitement. So really looking forward to seeing how this evolves.
I'm curious to know what everyone else is thinking that we haven't heard from.
Can you repeat that question? What?
Just what other people are thinking, somebody that we haven't heard from. Do they have any questions? Because there are people that we haven't heard from.
Even thumbs up, thumbs down.
Thumbs down.
Any reaction to all this?
Something.
Is that, you agree, Michelle?
Yeah, just an oh shucks.
I think all that I've heard so far, everybody has really good input, and I'm agreeing with everything that I've been hearing so far. So yeah, thanks.
This is going to be a lot of work, so I hope you're all okay. Yeah.
I think it's exciting, actually. I think this is going to be a really good process, and I think we're going to have an opportunity for FAC to be really engaged, more so than they have over the last couple of years. So I'm really, really looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'm thinking it's going to help bring our community together and get us into the resilient stage on this, if we can do this right.
Well, great. Thank you, everyone. There's no other, final thoughts or questions about the strategic planning for today. Let's move on to the executive committee update. This really ties in with the budget and the new role for FAC in how involved we are with the budget review. Going forward to align with, I keep calling it 1152, but it really is a statute now. But to align with 1152 the requirements for FAC for the budget review that are spelled out in 1152, we will need to have a meeting in May, a special meeting in May, to review the budget and also to vote on. Is it to approve the budget as well? Am I getting that correct?
So what we want to do is we want to just review where we're at. So we're going to go through that priority-based budget exercise. And then by that time, too, we should know kind of where everything is landing. Our teams are putting together kind of where we're at with all of our expenses right now and our FTE and all that stuff. And so we'll have all the information aligned, our budget, our funding streams, that sort of thing. We're going to bring that back to you to review. And we need to buy Andrea. Andrea's got to go give her baby a bath. So thanks, Andrea. So we will be bringing that back to you. This is part of FAC's role, is to review kind of where we're at in that process. We want to make sure that we have an opportunity to review that with you before we move forward for the final process, which will be the council will approve our budget. So, but we wanted FAC to be able to review it and say, okay, hey, we think you're missing this, or we want you to, consider that sort of a thing. So
specifically in late May, you will be reviewing the draft 2023 budget and the environmental public health fee adjustment scenarios we will have for you. That's May. And then in June, we'll review that with the county manager, review those adjustment scenarios with the county manager, the Board of Health, and our technical advisory committees. And then we will present to you in June a final draft budget based on those other conversations. Now, that will be June. And then in August, we submit it. But we will be – so that's how it works. May, the draft, and then June, the final draft budget.
So are we going to have a meeting in May to review?
What you're discussing right now, okay. I think. That we would want you to have a meeting in May and an additional meeting in May to do exactly that.
Yeah, I that's good with me. I just have one request that maybe we could receive the materials prior to the meeting. I have a hard time trying to read through and do a meeting. Okay, good.
And is this something that FACT needs to vote on today?
I know that you need to officially vote on it, Aru, but I think, I mean, you could, but I mean, I don't know if the bylaws require you to vote to have an additional meeting. I think you either vote on it or reach consensus or, you know, whatever works well with you.
Well, I think if anyone has any concerns about a May meeting, you know, we could certainly talk about that now. If not, I think we'll take that as a sign that everyone is okay with another meeting in May.
It'd be great to have enough, you know, quorum there so you can actually vote, you know, make it. I'm sorry, I cut somebody off there.
Yeah, did you, you said that you won't have it available to us till late May, though? Is that what I heard you say?
Well, we generally meet, what is it, the third, I'm losing track, the third or fourth Tuesday is when you generally meet anyway. Today is the fourth Tuesday, I believe, or do I have that right, or is it the third?
Yes.
And it's going back to what Peggy mentioned, is we want to have a little bit of time to take a look at it before we meet. So I'm just trying to get a better idea of when you're talking about that we would have something to review.
So we should have that for you. Hopefully, our administrative services director is not here. But we're building the draft budget right now. So I would hope what would work for you in terms of time to review? Would a week worth work or 2 weeks? Or we're going to do the best we can.
I think a week would be good for me. I don't know about everyone else.
I'm afraid if we got it 2 weeks ahead, we might put it off till the last few days before the meeting. So that's how I operate. So
I'm throwing Jeff under the bus here, but we'll make we'll let you know if that's a problem. But I think what we'll do is try to make a commitment, make a commitment to getting it to you a week ahead of the of your meeting in late May.
The other thing that we'll plan is that's going to be a really truncated meeting, so we're not going to be doing the whole director's report, all that stuff. All we will be doing is meeting to discuss the budget, and so it will be a relatively short, shorter than a regular FAC meeting is the plan.
We hope. That's our goal.
Are we thinking of doing that meeting on the 25th of May? Is that what?
The 24th. Okay. There are 5 Tuesdays in the month, though, so.
It's true. What do you think, Dr. Melnick? Can you have it ready to review by the 17th?
What do you think, Roxanne? Do you think Jeff isn't here?
I think that's probably doable. We will double check though with Jeff and see. The other thing I was just going to suggest, should we maybe send out a poll to see availability? You know, we're talking about another Tuesday meeting, but you know, it doesn't have to be a Tuesday. If you all have availability a different day, we could certainly do that. Would it help if we send maybe a poll or something like that?
Yeah, I like seeing to have the poll.
Go ahead, Sandy.
Sorry. I was just saying that we all had the fourth Thursday available when we changed the meetings, or of course Tuesdays. So it would make sense if we can keep it on that, if you can get the stuff to us sooner. I guess a poll would be nice to know if the fifth Tuesday is a possibility in case you need that extra time.
Yeah, I think we'd already done a poll not that long ago to figure out what would work, and after that poll we settled on the fourth Tuesday. Why don't we plan on the fourth Tuesday, but we can ask you, we can send out a poll to you saying if that doesn't work, would you be available for the fifth Tuesday? That sounds good. Plan on the fourth Tuesday, but send you out why don't we do this? Jeff is getting back from his vacation this week. We'll if it looks like there's the fourth Tuesday won't work, we'll plan on that right now, and if it looks like that won't work, We'll send you out a request to see if the fifth Tuesday will work for you. Roxanne, is that okay? Or
that works.
Is that okay with all of you?
Mm-hmm. It is, as long as we don't go to the third Tuesday, because that's when we have our evening council meeting,
right?
And on May 17th, that's the hearing on Palfrey.
Okay, exactly.
You're all going to be going to a lot of meetings.
This Tuesday is the day after a holiday, just for the record. This is Maria, and I was saying that this Tuesday is the day after a holiday, if anybody's taking a long holiday, but...
Okay. We'll try the fourth Tuesday since we've settled on that after that earlier round of polls. Okay.
We won't pressure Jeff. Believe me. We'll make it happen.
And we'll blame Roxanne for suggesting this. So
wait,
Jeff
is mad
at me.
Hold the foot on there.
Okay, it sounds like you're all okay. I mean, I didn't hear a consensus, but I didn't hear anybody objecting, so you're okay. You're all okay. It would be great to have a quorum.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm assuming same time. Work Tuesday at 5:30 on the 24th.
Yeah.
Right? Got it.
We'll work with Lydia on sending out an invitation to all of you for the fourth Tuesday.
We'll get a hold on the calendar.
Great. Does anyone have anything else for today that they would like to talk about? All right. Well, it is 7:12, so we will end a little early today then. Thank you all for being here today. It was a really fun, exciting discussion, and looking forward to seeing everyone in May.
And thank you for being our new chairperson, Aru.
Thank you, Aru. Thank you.
It is amazing.
Thank you, everyone.